I'm Tim Hernandez. Welcome to another edition of Words on a Wire. Our guest today is the multifaceted performance artist, investigator of histories and herstories, photographer, poet, and author Quentin Anna Wixwo. A former human rights worker, Wixwo uses salvaged old typewriters and old cameras to navigate unexpected corners of the world. She delves in these obscure places where they reveal through her work, through her writing, through her performance, reveals these multi-layered complexities of emotional histories, grief, spaces of grief, and human tragedy. It's just amazing. Many of the locations are forgotten and overlooked, you know, the sites where she goes and explores there. Wixwo writes stories from these places, attempting to put words to them. And she also writes about the people who have inhabited these spaces, bridging her work with the liminality of human experience, as she puts it, making stories that read like poems with images. This book that we're going to be exploring is hailed as, quote, heady, euphoric, singular, and surprising by Publishers Weekly. And I would agree it is all of that and so much more. There's no better way to describe the work that Wixwo is engaged with other than to hear it from the artist herself. And that is coming up right now, our discussion with author and investigative artist Quentin Anna Wixwo. Stick around. Quentin Anna Wixwo is a multifaceted, interdisciplinary artist integrating fiction, poetry, memoir, essay with her original photographs, performances, and video. Her books include the acclaimed collection of photographs and stories titled The Hope of Floating Has Carried Us This Far, and her latest book, A Long Curving Scar Where the Heart Should Be. Her other work has appeared in magazines such as Tin House, Conjunctions, The Kenyon Review, and Gulf Coast, as well as many anthologies and catalogs. Her projects have received multiple shows in places like New York and Germany and all around the globe. She holds fellowships from the Creative Capital and National Endowment for the Arts, YADO, and other places. She's a member of Penn USA and serves as a guest artist and visiting lecturer all around the world. She lives in rural northern New Mexico, and when necessary, she lives in New York City. Quentin Anna Wixwo, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Hi, thanks for having me.
How are you since last we spoke?
I'm wonderful. I'm up in a compound of old haunted house up in Sangre de Cristo Mountains.
So. Wow. And I know when you say that, you're not even kidding at all, right?
No.
You're serious.
We have several unmarked graves of to Spider Christ children.
We'll jump into that because I know that that's all. I would imagine that you're up there because it's a part of all of the sort of investigative and artistic work that you do, right? Is that why you're up there?
Yes.
Right. I figured.
Yes.
Yeah. Wonderful. Well, we'll get into your book, and I'm sure that we'll get a chance to circle back to what you're doing up there in that haunted house. Well, I'm really excited to talk with you about your latest book, A Long Curving Scar Where the Heart Should Be. I love your titles. Your last book was The Hope of Floating Has Carried Us This Far. How do you come up with titles, first of all? That's amazing.
They come from the poetry of the book. I don't think any of the characters have short things to say, so I figured they should have a long title.
Wow, that's a great way of putting it. They don't have anything short to say. That's true.
No.
And now this is your second time coming out on Words on a Wire, right? We had you here for your last book, The Hope of Floating Has Carried Us This Far.
Correct, yes.
Cool.
Lovely to be back.
Wonderful. Good. Maybe one day here in the studio, we'll get to like do it where, like, I've seen other studios where they have like the photographs of all the people they interviewed, like all around adorning the walls, you know, and your photograph will be up here. I think you have to like at least come here twice and then you get your photo up.
That sounds like a deal. We'll work on that.
Yeah. And it would be with one of your own photographs because you're an amazing photographer as well. Let me ask you just this before we jump into the book, you know, because for our listeners there, you know, you're a photographer. At least a performance artist, at least by my standards, from what I've seen, the work that you've done and the presentations you do is very performative, as well as, you know, provocative too. You're also a writer. What have you been doing since the last time we caught up with you here? I mean, I would imagine are you always constantly creating?
Sort of on a lot of different fronts. My human rights work and civil rights work are very closely tied to my artwork. So I've been starting a school in Santa Fe that's intersectional and then working on poetics and politics and performance and writing with kids out here. And I'm doing all the work alongside them. So they're quite inspiring. And vice versa, I think. So we're having a great time and getting some serious work done.
You know, and I follow you on Facebook also, and I see sometimes that, you know, you'll post like photographs of some of the projects you're doing with the youth there up in that area. And, you know, one of the things that's really, I mean, one of the first things, I think I told you this even in our last interview, one of the things that really drew me to your work is just your very hands-on experiential approach to creating and to writing and to performance. You know, you don't just sit in a sort of laboratory, in a safe, cushy laboratory somewhere and create things, you know, out of your mind. You're actually out in the world touching and feeling. And now that you're getting to teach that to the kids, I mean, why is that important to you?
There's a huge difference between theoretical knowledge and experiential knowledge. And I think a lot of folks who get heard the most are the ones with theoretical, you know, they've read about something, but they don't know it firsthand. And the folks who've actually lived life and experienced things and don't get heard very often, that's what really matters. And so I think getting the more complex parts of life and human experience down on paper, you know, performed or heard or seen, you have to be there and you have to be living it. There's no other way,
right?
I think, for me.
Yeah, no, I feel the same way. That's kind of the slant that I usually try and teach toward, you know, because, you know, the theoretical, I mean, on paper, right? I mean, that's a sort of very, very one-dimensional, maybe even two-dimensional. But once you get out into, like, nature and on paper is not nature in the actual, you know, when you go out into the world.
Exactly. And I think right now it's especially important because we have a lot of folks talking about hate crimes in the far right and who may not necessarily have ever actually faced that in person.
Right.
And, you know, the youth that I'm working with, that's a daily reality for them, and it has been for most of their lives. Their voices need to be heard.
Yeah.
It's great to have journalism and all that, but there's something very important about speaking from experience.
Absolutely. No, absolutely. I feel the same way. And then you know, manifesting that lived experience back into text, you know, is also obviously poses its own challenges. You know, how do you, well, I think one of the ways, actually, I'm just going to kind of answer that, but then I'll ask you that. I think one of the ways that it seems to me that you, go at that challenge or the way that you sort of work with that is through photography also, because it's not just textual, you know, your book is not just language, but it's also imagery and evocative of different senses. I mean, is that how you feel? I mean, you know, how do you feel about, how is that manifest in the writing?
Well, I have PTSD and a brain injury, and I find that a lot of the writers that I gravitate towards, the students or activists, also do. And there's a lot of sensory information that comes very quickly. And part of the literary practice is slowing down. I think working with old cameras with actual film means you sit and you watch the light. A lot of times I work with my students with just note cards. It's like all you have is this small space to fill in what you're feeling on your skin, how your body's reacting to what you're experiencing. And I think performance then engages the voice and engages the body. And the more aspects of oneself as a complete human being that you can bring to self-expression, more powerful that is.
Right.
And it can become immensely powerful the more senses that we're able to engage. It's a lot to channel. You know, it's just, you have to work your way up to it, I think, because there's just so much energy there of emotion and memory and feeling,
and you know, talking about the sensorial, like, you know, beyond the five senses, and without even sounding hokey or even, you know, making a caricature of this, but to actually, in a very real sense, you also draw attention or evoke or utilize the intuition, the almost the sixth sense, the idea of something beyond the five, the mere five that we have. And that's, you know, that's, I find that in your books, in both books, this one and your last one. You know, and then we go back to the beginning here, what you said right now, which is that you're actually at a place, at a haunted house right now. You know, so how does that play a role, you know?
Well, I'm very interested in liminal transition spaces where we're basically pushed. I think most people have experienced a situation where we are pushed beyond our own capacity as humans or what we think we're capable of. Mm-hmm. You know, the day-to-day has either a death or a tragedy or even something joyful has interrupted that mundane ability to process it. And then suddenly these other senses start to emerge. And like you said, I don't mean necessarily in a woo-woo kind of way, but this sense that there is something more, that someone who has passed away is maybe not completely gone. And we certainly see that in history and in local history and in sites and in landscapes that, you know, I'm here where there's a large number of unmarked graves. Mm-hmm. Well, they're marked, but without names. Where, why, where, you know, who are those people? That, in a sense, that's history. There is an actual, you know, ground to touch, but these people who are there are beyond our senses. They had stories, they had lives, something happened, and why they were hidden. You know,
absolutely.
It takes you off the map, you know?
For sure. It does, you know, and it really forces one as an artist, as an explorer, to not just think, you know, I mean, to use the cliche, not just to think outside the box, but to actually put yourself, you know, in that position. You know, I'm a believer that space holds energy, you know, especially spaces of grief, also spaces of joy, but spaces of grief particularly hold energy. And so it's different when you read about, say, a mass unmarked grave where anonymous folks are, or where folks are, were anonymously buried. And it's different when you read about it than when you're actually standing above it or standing there with it or even lying on the grass there. It's a whole other experience. And and I think that, you know, what's most intriguing to me about your books is that, you know, you're able to capture at least some, you know, some sort of almost the mood or the quality of that feeling in your books. And it's not just because of the text, like I said, it's also the photography. It's really evocative of being in these kinds of spaces. That said, I want to turn my attention now to the book itself, A Long Curving Scar Where the Heart Should Be. If you're just tuning in also, for our listeners, you're listening to Words on a Wire, and we're speaking with performance artist, author, photographer, and human rights activist Quentin Anna Wixwo about her new book, A Long Curving Scar Where the Heart Should Be. Now, the book is described as, and I think it's somewhere on the jacket, it says it unfolds on the unruly, mixed-race, queer-sexed margins of a conservative 1930s southern town. I personally found the book to be, as I'm, you know, along with everything else I've said about it, I found it to be actually kind of nostalgic in its tone. And at the same time, it's kind of forcing us into these uncharted waters, you know, of our own biases, our own ideas. How would you, in your own words, describe the book for our listeners?
To me, it's an exhumation. I mean, I think nostalgia is an interesting way of placing it because I really grew up in these towns where time had, in a sense, stopped. And I feel like it stopped because certain stories weren't being told and society simply couldn't progress, which is, again, what we're facing right now. These are, quote, ghosts from the past that are coming up in the United States around race and gender and, you know, so the nostalgia is that these folks were part of our communities as well. And yet unrecorded. And so to me, it's kind of plunging back and pulling up, you know, resurrecting in a way, what wasn't seen and what wasn't discussed and what's been lost and it's consciously nostalgic.
At the same
time, the uncharted part is that we haven't talked much about as a society about, you know, rural queerness amongst folks of color in the South. We haven't talked about those. So that's it's charted water by the people that live those lives.
Yeah, right. Absolutely.
who are my relatives and ancestors, but, you know, it's uncharted for contemporary conversation.
Absolutely. I would agree with all of that, with that description. In fact, you know, why don't you kick us off here by reading an excerpt from the book for our listeners?
One night when they were drinking alone, there was no sound, no movement, and they faced each other across a flickering table lit by the silver candelabra their mother had never sold. It held two candles. Sitting as such, it was though there was a mirror hung between the twin girls, old and heavy. The twins became a woman and her reflection. They reached out to touch their image, to feel it in a cold, hard, silver surface, to touch that cheek, that chin, that tip of nose, but their hands pushed straight through. They held their fingers there in the hot liquid of the candle flame, touching flesh instead of metal, paralyzed, each feeling for herself and feeling nothing. That's how they knew they were dead as well. Their hearts had departed from their bodies and they could not feel. How else to explain the candle burns along their arms, which they were unable to feel? No tingling of pain, nothing.
If you're just tuning in, that is the voice of author Quentin Anna Wixwell reading from her new book, A Long Curving Scar, Where the Heart Should Be. You know, as I was preparing for this interview, one of the things I kept doing was returning to the book and opening it just randomly in different places. And, you know, you could read it. I mean, to me, it's you know, it's obviously a narrative, but there's also a very almost like poetic quality in its structure. You know, I could open up the book at a different point and immediately jump into a different life and a different scenario, you know, a different portrait. And so I loved doing that because it felt like poetry to me in that way. But, you know, the story is really, I think, a symphony of just various peoples as it's, I think maybe it's on the jacket, they call them outcasts or various folks, various voices, sort of all housed within this single space that's like a sanctuary for, you know, for these folks. And then, you know, I find that given the context of your last book, The Hope of Floating has carried us this far. And of course, with your investigative work as an artist, I mean, how does this fit? How does this book fit into the trajectory of all of your work?
This book I've been working on for a very, 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 very long time. So it's chords I've run through. While it's technically fiction, it's a family history. And the characters and everyone are weaved in through thousands and thousands of family stories, none of which connect. I think that's also very much in line with the work that I do in general, where one goes to a site of or a community in which there's been great trauma, and nobody's stories, there's a different, everyone has a different version. There's 900 different, it's a kaleidoscope.
Right.
And to try to capture a single truth or a single experience is, we're way beyond that as a society. I think the idea of the overarching narrative or the overarching truth are the ones, it's gone. And
yeah,
so
absolutely,
that's what I'm most interested in, is how do we get everyone's voices heard and how do we do so in a way that captures beauty and individuality and that sublime quality of being in a room of people where someone says, no, this happened. No, it happened this way.
Yeah.
No, this, you know, this, I'm just fascinated by and really in love with the spectrum of human individuality and how everyone sees something slightly different. And where do we come together to make all of those pieces have a home? So
right.
I think each of the books are places where I try to say, here's a gathering place for all of those who have had this experience, who have been to this place, who've experienced these things. This is a sanctuary. This is a gathering place where all the voices can be heard. And
Right. Absolutely. I would completely agree with that. I mean, you know, that idea of that overarching truth, not existing anymore. And of course, you know, that's often argued, especially in terms of, literary genres and what have you, fiction, nonfiction, that kind of thing, journalism. But, you know, for me, all those labels aside, you know, the idea that in my own work as well, interviewing different people about one incident, you do find, and I love the way you put it, a kaleidoscope of voices, because while they are their sort of own individual micro panels, their own individual like expressions or their own individual memories, they are also reflecting off of the other memories. They all work together sort of to create a larger sense of truth, not the truth, but maybe something closer to truth. You know, there's not one definitive answer to any of these things, but rather the human realm, the human element, that perception is truth, right? That we ourselves, we perceive what our own truths are, and they are all equally as valid to the remembering of or to the memory of people or a legacy.
Yes, and I think it's also very interesting that in literature and in narrative, somehow the standard is to have one note.
Yes, absolutely.
And yet, if you look at music, a song has thousands of notes. The symphony, there's chords, upon chords. There's polyphonics. There's hundreds of different instruments, and each are. And that's considered successful.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely.
The more complex, it's a triumph to hear this like different timbre and different people's voices when a group sings together. And,
That's right.
And somehow translating that to literature, I think, is incredibly important.
It is. It is important. And, surprisingly, it's somewhat sort of subversive. It's surprisingly because it really is more along the lines of what actually takes place, But yet when we read a book, we want to find one narrative that works towards one truth, and that's just not how life is, it's interesting. One of the things too, going back to, I think as part of the big kaleidoscope, I mentioned the idea of poetry in your work, the structure of the book itself, but also even sentence to sentence, your book reads like poetry. And I'm going to give one example here for our listeners on page 30 in the story, What Lies in a Time of Need. I love this almost cataloging of images and moments that sort of cascade down the page. I'm reading here, all that bled, all that lived on paper and within pens. And then I skip a few lines. The god of the contents of bottles and jars, the god of emissions and tears and discharges, the god of sopping up. God, this is gorgeous writing, and it's very poetic. So I wanted to ask, how much does poetry influence not just the language itself, but even the structure of this book or all of your writing?
All I read is poetry. Mm-hmm. I don't know how I ended up as a fiction writer. I don't put myself forth as a poet, but I think I grew up on, I think I saw something on the jacket, but I grew up with the Torah, the King James Bible, the Egyptian Book of the Dead, and I had a lot of poetry, and it's how thoughts are formed. I think the internal monologue and the way in which we speak to each other at intimate moments is poetry. It's never, where's the semicolon and the part where you told me how much you love me?
The transcendent
moments of our lives are in poetic form, and so I have no interest in really. I mean, I'm perfectly capable of writing a nonfiction essay, and I spent years doing that, and found that so much was left out because you just can't pull on all those soul threads.
Right, and then poetry offers something that even that prose doesn't. I feel, prose can, and in some cases it does, but poetry really offers us or affords us that ability to leap, leap time and take giant sort of quantum leaps in time and space and, visually and, it's part of that kaleidoscope to me. And it's also very much close to the way we live,
Yeah, and it's also been always for the entire existence of humans on this planet, that's been the language of the people has been poetry. It hasn't fiction that has rules and forms as does poetry, but I think, it's the most gorgeous writing that's ever come out of most areas that have experienced hardship and poverty and injustice have been in poetry and in song. I mean,
yes.
No, it's a necessary form.
Absolutely.
And I think it's fundamentally a form of the people, from child to deathbed. It's fragments.
If you are just tuning in, we are speaking with the author and artist, Quentin Anna Wixwo, about her book, A Long Curving Scar Where the Heart Should Be. It's out with Stocking Horse Press. I have one more question for you, and then I'd like for you to take us out with another excerpt reading. So you said at the beginning of this interview that you are in a haunted house where there are unmarked graves or something to that effect. And what are you doing there? Would you mind sharing? Could you share with us?
Well,
is it a body, is some of your next work, or is it, how is this manifesting?
I have two long-term projects going on. One is the physical, long-term physical effects of genocide, and that's primarily in the U.S. South, the U.S. Southwest, and in Europe. And so I'm near a place where there was a lot of genocide against the Native Nations. And so that's part of two books that are forthcoming.
Wow.
But I also just came out to the property and saw a little girl who wasn't there wandering around. She's hung out with me for a while. And I always said there's people who believe in ghosts, and then there's people who just haven't seen, who don't believe in ghosts, and then there's people who just haven't seen them yet.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah.
So I didn't search this place out intentionally. I was just exploring, and then the land and the people here drew me in.
Right.
And it's near where I grew up, so it feels good to be home.
Oh, that's good. So you did grow up in that area. That's great. You know, that's, yeah. Would you mind then reading us another excerpt from the book?
They never spoke of him, not one of them, not once over all the years. The twins never once asked, what was he like? How did his voice sound? What was the color of his hair? They knew better, or they knew it somehow already. They added up what parts of themselves were unreflective of their mother and attributed to their father. Lafayette had held their joyous innocence and taken it with him. He had held the music and the summer nights beneath the stars and wild curls stirred by the wind. He had been the one who read poetry secretly at church. He had allowed butter to drip down his chin while eating corn and had white flashing grins suitable for every occasion. It was he who sat on the porch or in the barn or on an old chair in the yard listening to every heartbreak and triumph. He had been a sentimental old fool, that Lafayette. He had given Sweetwater goodnight kisses on their foreheads right as the first snowflakes of winter were falling. He was buttermilk, rich and golden and salted strong. He had taken laughter and burnished it into a swinging orb and run through the house with it like a censer, letting it drift into every highest corner, seep into every crack, wind its way up the stairs and into the attic. That was Lafayette. They didn't need to ask any questions.
Wonderful. And we have been speaking with author and artist and photographer and human rights activist Quentin Anna Wixwo about her new book, A Long Curving Scar Where the Heart Should Be. It's out with Stalking Horse Press. And you have to really pick this book up. It's fantastic. It's got photographs that are beautiful as well. And, they create a wonderful sort of a mood and a tone that complement and that work with and sometimes even against the text and the stories themselves. If you're into this, then you might want to also consider picking up her last book, The Hope of Floating Has Carried Us This Far, which was with Coffee House. Well, thank you, Quentin, Anna, and, you know, for being a second-time interviewee on our show. And we are big fans of all of your work, so please keep coming back to us.
Oh, it's very, very mutual. Thank you so much.
Absolutely. Congratulations, and take care.
Thank you.
We'd like to thank our guest today, the multi-talented artist, human rights worker, and investigative photographer, Quentin Anna Wixwo, whose book, A Long Curving Scar Where the Heart Should Be, is now out with Stalking Horse Press. You have to pick that up. You will not be disappointed. That wraps it up for this edition of Words on a Wire. I'd like to thank our wonderful producer, Lauren Terrazas. I'm Tim Hernandez, and we'll see you next week, same time, same place, on KTEP 88.5 FM.